You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go!
My guest, Gina Thomas, is a writer and speaker who works at a nonprofit that empowers others through holistic development. She served as a missionary in northern Mexico for 4 years, holds a master's degree in international development, and is the author of A Smoldering Wick, Igniting Missions Work with Sustainable Practices. She lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee with her husband, Andrew, and their two children. Her new book is called Separated by the Border, A Birth Mother, A Foster Mother, and A Migrant Child's 3,000-Mile Journey. We spoke together this fall at the Christian Community Development Association Conference in Dallas, Texas.
Gina, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So the new book is called Separated by the Border, A Birth Mother, A Foster Mother, and A Migrant Child's 3,000-Mile Journey. Let's start with Julia and Lupe. Mm-hmm. What brought Lupe and her daughter Julia to attempt to migrate to the United States?
Sure. So Lupe, from the time she was 13, was basically the caretaker of her grandparents. And by caretaker, I mean she was responsible to have, you know, the money to be able to find a job, to have money, to be able to take care of her grandparents. So the reason that she even came to the border was because her grandfather, who was living with her, so Lupe is the head of the household. Her grandfather and grandmother both live there as well. And then she has four children who live with her as well. So there came a point in time when her grandfather fell sick and really needed some very expensive medicine. And Lupe did not have the money to purchase that medicine. But throughout her life, and kind of part of her life, was traveling to different places for jobs and sending money back to her family. And so when she was talking to friends and family and telling them that this was an issue, a friend had told her that she should come to the States. And so her plan all along was to come for a couple of months, find a good job, and be able to send money back to her home, specifically so that her grandfather, A, did not die, and B, was able to get the medication that he needed.
Can you talk a little bit about the context of Honduras? And there's a lot of poverty there, and there's also a lot of the income there is from remittances. Mm-hmm. And so what are remittances?
Yeah.
And what's the context for why there's such a high rate of poverty in Honduras?
Yeah, there's a lot of different factors that play into the poverty rate there. But specifically, remittances is money that is sent usually from the States to Honduras. And that's usually sent by family and friends who are living in a developed country. And so the United States is one of the largest remittance sending countries to Honduras. Some of the poverty there is certainly from corruption. There's a lot of poverty there. I talk about in my book a little bit about the banana empire and how corporations were, feeding into that. Multinational corporations were feeding into the corruption. There was a lot of power that was kind of like, I talk about like colonialistic capitalism that's happening there, that happened there and continues to happen there. And just how devastating that can be to a community. Specifically, in their context, they have some factories that are polluting the river that's right near where they live. So there's several different factors. There's also there's a lot of machismo that happens there. So her being the woman and the head of the household is a challenging position for her to be in. Trying to find a job that actually can provide for her family is not easy to do. And having had to be the breadwinner for the household since she was 13, she doesn't have the education that really is necessary in today's day for her to get a decent job to be able to provide for six people under her roof. So, yeah, there's a lot of different factors to that. And certainly the U.S. has played its own hand in creating the poverty that's there.
And so my understanding is that part of that is like the U.S., like the actual like government has had its hand in some things that have contributed to those situations.
Yep.
But also American businesses,
correct,
American capitalism that comes in and takes away, you know, things like unions or rights to unionize,
right,
workers' rights, and also seems to, this is one of the things I gathered, they seem to also kind of set up monopolies, so there's not competition.
Right.
And then those businesses also get very involved in the politics of,
yep,
of the country, even, yep, to the point of helping to undermine certain leaders and overthrow certain,
yep,
leaders. That was crazy to me to read, that a business would be involved in the company's or in a country's politics,
yeah,
to that degree,
yeah,
to actually like overthrow a government.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
So that kind of sets the stage of like why, because I think most of us know in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a huge migrant crisis.
Right.
That we've always had immigrants come in, but that in the last, again, 2, 3, 4 years, it's grown.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like this kind of perfect storm of poverty, corruption, violence,
mm-hmm,
is the thing that's been the driving force behind all that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of push factors, pushing people out of the country, pulling them to the United States. So push and pull factors that are happening specifically in the Northern Triangle, which is Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Those countries have been for several years now. If you look on like UN websites and stuff, like the United Nations calls it a refugee crisis. And unfortunately, the way that it's being looked at currently, from most, and I would say most white evangelicals as well, and from most Americans, and certainly in the news, is that this is like people coming to take our land and to take our jobs.
Right. Yeah. They're invaders.
Right.
Yeah.
Rather than seeing it as a refugee crisis, which is what it is. So.
Yeah. So, Lupe only, you mentioned she had 4 children total. Is that right?
Yeah.
But only takes, Julio with her, correct?
Correct.
And has the foresight enough to find someone who I'm gathering is kind of like a family friend,
uh-huh,
who she gets him to agree to kind of legally be her daughter's stepfather.
Correct.
She finds out that he's going to travel as well, and he agrees to.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have, I don't think you had tons of information about him and who he was, but it seemed like a guy who's trying to do a good thing for someone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And tried to take care of Julia as well, as much,
yeah,
as he can.
Right.
So that was a lot of foresight, and it's, and proved to be a really good decision on,
mm-hmm,
that journey. So they hire a smuggler,
mm-hmm,
who they had heard from someone else had a fairly decent experience making it to the U.S.
Correct.
But it turned out to be a horrible experience.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So I was curious, I've always been curious about like the mechanics of coyotes,
mm-hmm,
and human smugglers of getting people across. Are they generally, it seemed like they're generally traveling at night.
Mm-hmm.
And in some part of this journey, they're like in the back of a tractor trailer, right?
Right.
And so is that, that part of it is pretty normal, I'm guessing. Like, that's generally what happens.
So I've heard a couple of different things, particularly in Julia and Lupe's story, that is how it happens for them. But I've also heard stories where it's a cheaper price, but basically a smuggler will use a telephone and send the person by themselves, but like give them directions to the next place.
I gotcha.
And then, you know, they call again at that next place and get the next step of directions. And so there's different ways of it being done. And certainly when there's a large group, it's usually done this way in the back of a tractor trailer.
And it sounds like an incredible amount of money is made by yes. the people doing this.
Absolutely.
And so you have an extremely vulnerable group.
Yep.
That they're, you know, especially once they leave their home country, they're in a country that is foreign to them, you know, by definition.
Yep.
And the only thing they have is the transportation that the smuggler is providing for them. So they're, correct. I guess what I'm getting at, they're extremely vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And so often we hear the stories of, you know, smugglers saying one thing and then getting halfway there, getting part of the journey and saying, okay, the price has changed now.
Correct.
And they're stuck. They have no way to, they have no bargaining power at that point.
There's nothing else to do. Yeah, they're very much at the mercy of the smugglers.
And that happened with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not only that, but they're also, these migrants are incredibly susceptible to violence and sexual exploitation.
Yep.
Can you tell a little bit of Lupe's story with that?
Yeah. So when they arrived at the border town on the Mexico side, the smugglers decided to separate Lupe, the mom, from her daughter. They sent her daughter on with her stepdad, and Lupe stayed behind, and she was exploited sexually several times, was prostituted, and basically held in captivity for a couple of months. It's not 100% clear exactly the dates of, you know, when she was in custody with them and when she got out. It was at least a month, probably more like two. She suffered a lot at their hands, was able to escape finally and ended up going to a Mexican like a migration place. Okay. And so she received some health care and help there, and actually also got to receive some help along the way to even get there, which was a beautiful piece of the story, I think, too.
Yeah, totally. And a few things that were striking, it seemed like along the way, I guess they would stop for the night, and it was essentially the kind of lead smuggler had decided that just... she was going to prostitute Lupe out mm-hmm. during the night.
Yeah.
And then take her back in the morning.
Yep.
And she would take care of Julia again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, that was her life as they were traveling.
Yes.
And there was a good chance. I mean, at any point, the smuggler just could have said, and it sounded like it was discussed, that they would quote unquote keep her.
Yeah.
That they would just.
Yep.
That would just be her life from then on out, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
The other thing that you mentioned, which was striking to read, was that when she does escape, she's helped by this Mexican family that don't know her from anyone. I mean, it's like they literally found her on the road and said, come to our home.
Yeah.
We will take care of you.
Yeah.
And were sound like they're just so loving towards her and taking care of her.
Yep.
And which is a story we'd never hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and that particular family was so, you know, frustrated by the things that they knew that were happening, like the ways that other Mexicans were oppressing her as a Central American immigrant. And I think that's, my hope is that one thing that can be seen in the book is with my own journey in life in Honduras and then in Mexico is that even though there were these horrible things that happened in Mexico, there are so many amazing Mexicans, not only that I know, but that she knew along the way, who really point to the fact that we just can't make blanket statements about any group of people ever. It's just not okay to do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, the way that racism works is we look at a group of people and say that they're different.
Right.
Right. And so we have this, we make blanket statements and blanket thoughts about who Mexicans are.
Yeah. Yep.
There are very wonderful, upright, as we saw in the book, caring, loving, self-giving people in Mexico right now.
Yes.
They're caring for these people.
Yes. Amen.
So, were you going to say something else about that?
No.
Okay. So, long story short about Lupe there is she winds up getting, I guess it would be technically deported from Mexico back to Honduras.
Yeah.
So she finds her way there. She finds out that Julia did make it to the States.
Mm-hmm.
Once she's here in the States, she's taken away from Carlos. I don't think we've said his name yet, but her legal stepfather.
Yeah.
And remind me, what time period was this? Was this when, you know, Trump's new policy was family separations, that we no tolerance, zero tolerance.
Right.
Systematically, we're going to separate children from their parents. Was it during that time that she was taken away, or do you know for sure?
So it's a little bit unclear because she came to the border, her and Carlos came to the border in likely October or November of 2017. Zero tolerance policy was officially announced April of 2018.
Okay, so it's before that.
That was actually only announced on the Department of Justice's website. So the newspapers, like news media, didn't really pick it up until May.
It was under the radar for a while.
Yep, so at least a month of that. So around May is when newspapers really started to showcase this zero tolerance policy. And that went from May until the end of June of 2018. But in January of 2019, there were reports showing that most likely zero tolerance was happening even prior to that DOJ announcement. So most likely zero tolerance had started being in effect in July of 2017. So if that actually was the case, then when they crossed over in October, November of 2017, it could have been that they were separated specifically because of that. It could have also been because even though he had stepdad status in Honduras, the United States requires that there's a marriage certificate for stepdad status. So that's kind of all unclear to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's also my understanding that even now, even though the zero tolerance policy is not in place, they're still separating a lot of children, a lot of minors from their parents. My understanding is because the rules say that if they suspect that the child is in danger, so I think what that's meant to do is to say if they're in the possession of a human trafficker,
correct,
then you should separate them. But the problem is, my understanding is the problem is that there are no guidelines for that. So that's under the
discretion
of like whoever might be in charge, whatever kind of immigration official might be. And so, so it sounds like it's, although it's slowed down from zero tolerance, it's still regularly happening where children are being taken from their rightful guardian.
Yeah, and part of that, at least, is kind of broader than the particular Border Patrol agent at the moment, is that the current administration is really fighting against this thing called the Flores Agreement, which was back in 1999, that said that children could only be held for 20 days.
Right.
So they're really trying hard to push over this legal rule that says that children can't be held longer. And so part of that zero tolerance policy was if you separate the children from the parents, then you can hold the parents for as long as you want. The children are the only ones who have to be...
You have to deal with
them. Yeah, in 20 days. So that's part of the issue there that's at play.
And my understanding, Gina, with zero tolerance was, the internal logic of it was, we're following the letter of the law. The people are coming across, they're breaking the law, they're being arrested. And when a person is arrested, they can't take children to whatever, jail or, you know, like that was the internal logic of it, right?
And also the idea that if we were to do this, then people would stop coming.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at is this is all simply to be punitive.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
And so, so like my also understanding is that in previous administrations, the policy, the administrative orders were when we detain a migrant, we're going to detain the families together.
Right.
And often they would be processed, they would be released, and then have a later court date.
Right.
Whereas the current administration, you know, separates when they can and detains people for as long as possible.
Yeah.
And this seems to be really against American interests. What I mean is it is incredibly expensive to hold these people, to, you know, feed them, however poorly we're doing that, but they're being fed something, to provide these camps, setting up camps in the middle of the desert where there were none before. It's extremely expensive to do that.
Yeah.
And so the only motivation is to be punitive.
Well, here's the thing. It's expensive to the government, but when you're talking about American interests, which American interests are you talking about? So the private, you know, prison industry is getting lots and lots of money from this.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah. So maybe it would be more accurate to say the taxpayer interest.
There you go.
Yes. Yeah. Not the special
interest. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
So Carlos gets deported pretty quickly, it sounds like, from what we know.
Yeah.
And I haven't talked a lot, or we haven't talked a lot about Julia. How old was she?
She was five.
She was five.
Yeah.
Okay. And we don't know a lot about her time in a detention center.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like she forgot a lot of that. Mm-hmm. It's probably a result of the trauma that she was going through.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But eventually, and you were living in North Carolina at this time?
Mm-hmm.
So how did she get to North Carolina?
Yeah.
Let's start there.
So when we're talking about that Flores agreement, the agreement says that a child needs to go to the least restrictive, safe, and appropriate place for them to live. And so a lot of times that in these cases, Julia was because she was then separated from Carlos, she was deemed an unaccompanied minor. Unaccompanied minors then go through the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and they resettle them to this, like, least restrictive place, right?
Yeah, so, I'm forgetting there was a spot between detention center and your house.
Yeah, so that ended up being Carlos, her stepdad's sister's house in North Carolina.
Yeah. Which is crazy on its own.
Yes.
Because the reason given for separating her from Carlos was because he was not her rightful, in their eyes, her legal stepfather.
Right.
And then they turn around
and
place her in Carlos's sister's house.
Yes. Thank you for saying that. I'm like, how is this? So,
if
it wasn't zero tolerance, okay. But if it wasn't zero tolerance, that means that it was like they did not think that he was stepdad's status.
Right. Yeah.
And he was fit to watch her, but they thought that his sister was fit to watch her. That doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, it kind of mirrors, you know, the U.S. foster system where, you know, they look for next of kin, right?
Yeah.
But
that's right.
Again,
right.
Our government has determined we don't acknowledge that you're kin.
Right.
But they put her there anyway.
Right. And so, and the tricky thing about all this, and I don't want to push away like the trauma that happened to her at this house because she was neglected. At the same time, I want to recognize that sponsorship families don't get money like foster families do.
Sure.
Sponsorship families often feel a familial
obligation
to take in a child. And in this particular case, it was two single moms who were living together with school-age children of their own. And when a child came in that was not school-age, because she was not quite, you know, the right age, she had turned five after the cutoff, what options did they have for her? I mean, they couldn't afford to send her to a preschool.
Yeah.
So, and they probably didn't know how to go about trying to find any kind of government help to send her to a preschool. And Office of Refugee Resettlement doesn't do any of that. So for ORR, they put her in the home, and then 30 days later, they call the home to check on them. And that's the extent of their accountability to these homes. Yeah. So, you know, for the aunts that were trying to do their best living in this world that they have, it was a very challenging situation for them as well. And so Julia was neglected and ended up kind of wandering the streets trying to find a neighbor who would take her in for a little bit during the day when everyone was gone, and the police were called. And so that's how she ended up in foster care.
And I want to take a step back, because you talked about the Office of Refugees and Resettlements making that phone call.
Yeah.
And it made big news
yeah.
a little bit after that time that the government had quote unquote lost X number of children.
Yep.
And so that's exactly how that happened.
That's
and
right.
so,
that's right.
You know, I think my understanding was some of that was they made the phone call, no one answered. So technically they're lost.
Right.
So some weren't actually
right.
lost.
Right.
But also, part of the problem was they're sending them to people who were often undocumented people themselves.
Correct.
The ORR now has this affiliation with ICE.
Yep.
So you're undocumented and ICE is calling you.
Right.
Or you see it that way.
Right. Right.
And so the logical thing right. to do is to avoid
That's
that
right.
conversation.
That's right.
So another
Absolutely.
Kind of like comedy of errors on the U.S. government's part
right.
there. So,
yeah.
Okay. So then Julia is brought into the foster care system.
Right.
This is really when your story comes in mm-hmm. and your background comes in mm-hmm. because thankfully the foster care system is concerned about not just sending this girl who only speaks Spanish to an only English speaking house.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have this long history of living mm-hmm. one in Honduras
yeah.
and in Mexico for a long time.
Yeah.
And you and Andrew speak Spanish pretty fluently.
Yeah.
Talk about when you first got the phone call
mm-hmm.
from you know, a caseworker about Julia.
Yeah. So when we got the call or text, I can't remember right now which one was first, but basically they didn't know the story of this little girl. They didn't understand anything that was happening because she was only speaking Spanish to them. And so they had her in the office and they called us and they said, it looks like her parents were deported and she was left behind. So we need somebody to watch her for the weekend, basically. And then ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ORR will be at court on Monday. So we just need somebody. This was a Friday, so she said we just need somebody to watch her for the weekend. And I was like, oh, well, if the federal government's involved, like, they're definitely going to come on Monday. And here's, once again,
There's
my husband's
one thing
insight.
I can trust.
that I don't have his foresight, I guess. He was like, no way. This isn't just going to be this quick. But he still said, yeah, let's do this. And so we, you know, took her for the weekend, and then I took off Monday from work and we went to court and nobody showed up. And then we did it again the next Monday and nobody showed up again.
So a weekend turned into a week.
Yep.
And you've also glazed over this part that you have your own two children.
Right.
And another foster
right.
child
yep.
in your house at
yep.
the time.
Yep.
Who had been there? How long had Emma been there?
She had been there, I think, for 4 months by the time. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe longer.
So you think we can be the parent of four kids for a weekend.
Right.
And then it turns into a week.
Right.
And then what happened after that week?
And then after that week, basically she was then turned over into, like, officially into state custody. And we had to make a big decision. We had previously had two foster kids in our home along with our two biological kids. And it was really just more than we could handle as a family. And we had told ourselves we wouldn't do that again. So we had to make a decision of, if we were going to let Julia be the foster child that stayed in our home until we figured all this stuff out. And there was so much that we didn't know. Or if Emma was going to stay in our home. And that, like, honestly, that was the hardest decision of my life, without a doubt. And it still sucks thinking about it, to be really honest. And we ended up deciding that we could provide something to Julia that, like, we didn't know of any other foster parents where both parents spoke Spanish. And of course the state could have then gone to, like, the private agencies like they do. But we decided that we would keep Julia in our home and figure it out. And then, that meant that Emma needed to go to another home. They did stay, they were together for 1 month in our home. And I mean, honestly, like, if there was like, somehow somebody had, like, videoed this, I mean, it was just ridiculous and hilarious looking back on it. But there were so many arguments of, like, between the two of them, they shared a room together. One was speaking English, the other speaking Spanish. They couldn't understand each other. They would fight over the same toy, right? And so it was just like this crazy, just this very, very chaotic time in our life. And we were speaking Spanish and English in the home so much that we got confused and we would constantly speak the wrong language to the wrong child. It was more than we could handle. And I think I tried to hang on longer than maybe I should have to the idea that we could do this. It turned out that we just really needed to make a change and figure out what to do from there. So Emma ended up going to a home that she now, I can happily say, has been adopted. Yeah. Is it really, really cool?
Because you got to...
Story.
You got to talk with the family that's occurred.
Yeah.
And it seemed like a really wonderful place.
Yeah, it really is and has been. And it's been really fun to watch her just blossom and flourish in that place. And in a home with a mom who had a very similar background that Emma did in her own childhood, in her own life. And that family was able to give her one-on-one attention that we just couldn't and never would be able to because we have two of our own kids. So,
yeah. What kind of a little girl was Julia? What was her personality like?
She is so spunky. Oh, my goodness. She never had nothing to say about anything. So she always had an opinion about everything. I got my hair cut like this. I have this kind of weird haircut with a shaved side. And the first thing that she told me was, like, that is not a woman's haircut.
I hate to tell you.
Yeah, like, you need to recognize. If she had opinions about our fashion, she had opinions about, like, what we ate. I mean, there's always opinions about everything. So very vibrant, very, just interesting and entertaining little girl for sure. Just amazing, really.
And how long was she in your house for?
She was in our home for, 4 months. So, like, towards the end of February until July.
And were you the first time that she, no, she got to talk to her mom when she was at,
Marta.
Yeah, uh-huh. Marta. Uh-huh. Okay. She got to talk to her mom for the first time there.
Yeah, at her sponsorship family.
Which sounded difficult because Lupe could tell that she wasn't in the best of circumstances.
Yeah.
But was kind of powerless to do anything about it and didn't want to make it worse for her.
Right.
Right. And then when Julia goes to your house, she's obviously still in contact with her. And then, but also you and Lupe become friends at that point.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, it was definitely unexpected. I mean, I wasn't exactly sure what had happened, you know, until we talked to her. I think it was like 10 days or so after she had come into our home. We hadn't spoken to Lupe. We didn't have contact with her. And so when I talked to her, I kind of imagined that she would maybe be an inappropriate mom.
Sure.
To be honest. And so that's like kind of what you're trained for in foster care. And that might come out bad, but it's the truth. And so, you know, with foster care, you're always trying, like, parents have to go through classes, and whether it's parenting or drug or whatever, rehabilitation classes. And so I just kind of, I don't even know why, but I just assumed that that there was something else going on there. I had no idea the backstory of what all had happened. And so wasn't sure what to expect. Well, when we finally were able to video chat with her, I mean, it was just immediately apparent that this was an amazing mom who really missed her kid and was talking to her daughter in the same way I would have talked to my daughter in, you know, if anything like that had happened to us. And she, the social worker, had asked her not to be emotional in that first call with,
oh, wow.
Yeah, with her daughter. And again, neither one of us, social worker or I, knew any of the backstory. So now looking back on it, to ask that, now knowing her story, like such an injustice in itself, right?
Right, right.
And she did it. She was happy. She was like, I mean, she was so excited for her. Julia was walking around the house with a video camera, with the phone, just like showing her
the new place,
her new blanket, and yeah, all that stuff. And so, Julia was very happy and excited to show her mom these things. And then her mom was very reciprocal on that. Well, then, after she was done talking to Julia, then her and I talked. I remember I closed the door to my room. I sat down on the floor in my bedroom and talked to her and found out more of her story. And at that point, I didn't know any of the trauma that had happened at the border to her. But I heard a mother who was longing for her daughter that she had been separated from. And it just completely wrecked me. And I then was wrecked over and over and over again, as more and more of these stories were coming out, and learning more about what our administration was doing. But it was, yeah, it was just clear that this was a mom who really loved her little girl and really missed her and was a safe and appropriate and loving mom. And that they needed to be back together. It was immediately evident that they need to be back together.
I can't imagine from Lupe's standpoint of, my kid is in a foreign country alone without me.
Yeah.
In a state I've probably never heard of, in a city I've never heard of. We know that the government has placed her in a neglectful situation once already.
Right.
And just how completely terrifying and powerless that would be.
Yeah.
And then I can also imagine you're in Andrew's situation and probably wanting to very much communicate to her and reassure her that we will take care of your daughter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And just like wanting to really convey that message to her.
Yeah, absolutely. It was so hard to even imagine what she was thinking and feeling in all of that. And at the time they had been separated so she was in our home for 8 months total. I think I said the wrong thing earlier. She was separated in our home for 4 months, but she was separated from her mom for 8 months.
Gotcha.
And so by the time we talked on the phone, I think they had been separated for about 5 months at that time. And, to try to imagine what that was like. And, you know, Julio's five. And at the time I had a 6-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter, and to try to imagine being separated from either one of them or both of them for any amount of time was devastating. And I think if anything, as Christians, we owe other human beings that empathy.
Yeah. And I can imagine wanting to convey that, hey, I know that this is a terrible situation and I know it has to be torture. But at the very least, you can go to sleep at night knowing that your daughter's safe.
Yeah.
And yep. Try. And the thing is, all you could do, I mean, I can imagine you sitting on, like, it sounded like you guys talked on, like, FaceTime or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're saying, and I can imagine saying, like, or thinking, there's no way, really, for her to know that you're who you say you
right.
are. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because also, Lupe is someone who's, like, over and over again on the journey that she went, where people who were supposed to take care of her betrayed her.
Yeah.
And yeah. abused her and did horrible things for her, to her.
Yeah.
And so, again, just try. I'm just struck with the position that you would have been in and she would have been in, the trying to communicate, you know, we get the horrible things that have happened, but at the very least, know that she's safe with
yeah.
us and we will take care of her.
Yeah. Yeah. It, again, not knowing a lot of that trauma in the background at that moment in time, when she told me the next night, so we talked, it was one night, and then she had, you know, texted me and said that that night was the first time that she had slept well in, like, months.
Wow.
Yeah. And she could tell, you know, you can tell when your child feels safe or
right,
feels welcome.
Right. Yep.
And so it was a contrast for her from the other times that she had video chatted with Julio when she was at the other home, that, you know, she saw her countenance, you know, your child's countenance, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was a pretty huge thing for her to just know that she was safe. And for Julia to walk around the house and be so excited and, like, prancing around, like, literally
yeah.
prancing around the house,
yeah.
I mean, shows that she felt safe there. At the same time, Julia still had trauma of her own and tried to run away a couple times. So, you know, none of it was, like, you know, this beautiful, wonderful thing that, like, there was
yeah.
no hardship in. But... for her to know that was a place of peace was pretty huge. And for us to feel that too was a big deal. So.
So you guys obviously became very close
mm-hmm.
in the 4 months that she was with you.
Yeah.
And you work, Lupe works, and there, it, you know, becomes possible for them to reunite.
Yeah.
I also know that, again, when you first had her in your home, you knew nothing about the story. And there, it seems like there's always, in foster care, there's always the possibility, even if it's remote, that you might have an opportunity to adopt this
yeah.
child.
Yeah.
And so one of the big things that people in foster care say is that reunification is the best
mm-hmm.
option.
Mm-hmm.
And that people
mm-hmm.
going into foster care have to know that.
Yeah.
That them living in your house forever is not the best option.
Right. That's
and,
right.
And it seems to me that the reason that's why that is so repeated in the foster care system is because parents who bond with a child and then have to let them go back
mm-hmm.
to their birth parents
mm-hmm.
is an extremely painful thing to
right
do.
Right. It is painful,
even when you know it's the best thing.
That's right. And that is right there is, I think, the reason that most it's the reason that I've heard the most, and certainly the one that I had myself, for not getting involved in foster care.
Yeah.
And I think that as Christians, we have to take a really hard look at what that means and why we have that, why that is a barrier. Because for me personally, it was a barrier because I want to possess the children that I have.
Mm.
And that is its own idol. And it's important for us to deal with that idol, certainly before getting involved in foster care. Sadly, I think most people don't deal with that. And it can be a very challenging thing because it's easy as foster parents, you know, a lot of people kind of say you don't really have a lot of power, but there is advocacy that you do underneath it all, whether it's overt or not, for reunification or not for reunification. And it's really not up to us as foster parents to decide what's best for the child. And that is a situation where we have to lay down the power and say, I don't actually know the whole story. Now, I say that having had only my small amount of experience in foster care, and so I know foster parents who have had to say goodbye to children who were going back into situations that really sounded awful.
Yeah, yeah.
And that has to be on the table as well when we're talking about all this stuff. Like, it's not always in the best interest, I don't think, what the state decides to do.
Sure. I get the feeling a lot of times, for better or for worse, they err on the side of going back to the birth parents.
Yeah.
And you know, part of that, maybe it should be so.
Yeah.
There's a legacy of white people taking away children of oppressed minority groups.
Yep. Yep. And there's racism in foster care.
And that's right. And we're not immune to any of that right now.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, I think if a side has to be aired on, that's probably the one that it should.
Right.
Really seeing kids back to parents who aren't the best is probably better than taking them away from parents who are good parents.
Yep. Yeah. And really, I think one of the biggest, the biggest ways that we kind of truncate the gospel when we look at foster care, adoption, orphan care in general, is that our focus is only on the child. And when we focus only on the child, it's easy to dehumanize the parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when That's we good. Look at the Bible and we look at, like, the message of Imago Dei that's in every human being, then we have to also look at the parents in the same and look at the family as a unit as much as possible, I think. And that means rooting for and cheering on the biological parents who in foster care are struggling to do what they need to do to get their children back. I see very, very few ministries and organizations that are actually trying to help those people. Tons of ministries and organizations trying to help the children. Mm. But if we're going to say that we're for life and we're for family and we're pro-family values, then we need to recognize first and foremost that for me, foster care, like, the only reason that I'm not one of those biological parents whose children is taken away from them is because I have a communal support system that helps me when I don't have money.
Right.
And I can lean on them to pay for my rent, which we've had to do, when I can't pay it myself. So I think we have to recognize that there's very little difference there. The difference is a communal support system. And if that's non-existent, then as the church, we've got to be the people who do that. That's what Shalom is all about, right?
Yeah.
So I do think I'm starting to see more and more of this, like, family strengthening viewpoint rather than, like, orphan care specific. And I think that it is a much broader and more robust view of what the gospel says to these situations.
So you said, you know, you had realized when the first time that you talked to Lupe that she was a good mother, you know, a loving mother, and the right thing to do was mm-hmm. reunification. So I can imagine, that was somewhat bittersweet because you knew that adoption for her, you adopting her, wasn't the right thing. And then I can imagine a large amount of a bittersweet experience when you actually, you know, flew to Honduras and brought her back to her mother.
Yeah.
And she was, you know, officially out of your life on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Yeah, so when we talk about the adoption piece, adoption has been a dream of mine since I was 16 years old. So to, you know, when we go back to that idea of what is the idol in your life right now when it comes to this particular situation, like, I think my default would be, and could have easily, and social workers told us, it would have been easy. It would have been easier and cheaper for the state to just adopt her out to us. And again, this is like an all of my adult life dream to adopt a child. We can talk about that another day, but that knowing adopting a child means taking them away from the biological mother that God has given her that is appropriate and safe for her to be at, was its own thing for me personally, to recognize that and to even silence the voices, because there were actual people who said, like, why are you doing this?
Sure.
And to me, it's incredibly arrogant of me to say that I can provide a better life for her than her mother can simply because of where she lives or the color of her skin or the country that she calls home. Like, that is the epitome of white savior complex, right?
Right.
And sadly, it's permeates throughout adoption a lot. And I don't want to say there aren't nuances to it, because there certainly are. And it's not that simple for everyone. But in our case, it was very clear she needed to be back home. That was the right thing to do. So it was pretty quick, actually. Once I kind of, you know, had that conversation with Lupe, the shift from, like, this might turn into adoption to, nope, this needs to be reunification, was pretty quick for both Andrew and I. And then, you know, it took a while to get to the point of being able to even get her back to her home. So it was like a 4-month journey of getting all the right paperwork and getting the court order, you know, signed and all that kind of stuff, to get her back home. So when we arrived, when we landed, at the airport in Honduras, I called Lupe and she was like 5 minutes away, which turned into like 30 minutes away, which is not that surprising knowing, the culture, but also it was just like, it took 4 months to get to this moment.
Right.
Like this 5 minutes, this drawing out is like, seems like an eternity. But yeah, she arrived at the airport, was running up the stairs, and Julia saw her and like started jumping up and down and was like, can I go run out to her? And I was like, absolutely go. So just to see that and to be in that moment, I mean, really was very, very surreal.
I can imagine.
Yeah. It's just awesome. Awesome. Like, this is, you know, you don't often, when you're in justice work, you don't often get to see justice happen from injustices that have happened. And in that moment, there was a little piece of that goes beyond real, you know, it goes beyond reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you got to spend a good amount of time with Lupe and with their extended family as well, and got to kind of see a little glimpse into their world and what kind of people they were.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really wonderful to be able to go to her home. And even in that, just to see some of the differences that in like cultural differences that we had, things like, you know, closing the door to the bathroom and, you know.
Yeah. So they go like swimming naked in the river or whatever. And you're like, well, that's why she never closed the bathroom door.
Like, it's not a big deal for her.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Or like the toys in the home were all the kids' toys. And we're like, that's why like the sharing thing was an issue.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, when you're in foster care, you have certain rules, like, especially if you have a male child of your own in the home and then a female foster, like, you have to have, you have to make sure that doors are closed and things aren't seen. And so like to arrive in Honduras and, you know, she's just changing out in the open and it's not a big deal. So yeah, there was just a lot of like those cultural differences that that were very, I mean, I knew that they were there, especially having lived in Honduras, but to see them in the moment was like, oh, okay, that makes so much more sense. This is why we argued over this for so long. Yeah.
I loved, one of my favorite things was like, again, she's a five-year-old girl, and there's times in your house she'd be like, I can really go for some coffee right now. That is so funny. Yes. I never knew that in other countries, just like giving a kid a cup of coffee is no big deal.
Oh, the best thing was when was when her grandmother, she had said a couple of times, like, I just really want some coffee and a piece of bread right now, like for, you know, in the morning when she woke up. And when we arrived there and I got to meet her grandma, one morning I heard her grandma say, oh, this is just so wonderful to drink a cup of coffee and eat some bread. And I was like, oh man, the apple doesn't fall far.
Yeah.
This is her. Like, she's home, you know, she's home.
That's
and she gets
so
to drink
funny.
Coffee all she wants now. And
how does she drink it there? Is she drinking like black coffee?
Yeah. Black coffee. Yeah.
It's so crazy.
Yeah. That's it's got so sugar funny. In it.
So okay. It's got something.
Yeah.
It's not,
yep,
okay.
Yep.
But still,
yeah.
But it's not like, yeah.
Yeah.
A total Frappuccino or anything.
Right, absolutely.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
That's like, we're big coffee drinkers, and every once in a while our kids want a taste. And
uh-huh.
it's really not like we're worried about it being unhealthy for them. It's like, we don't want to put up with what this is going
right.
to do to you in a second. We've seen you on sugar. We don't want to see you on caffeine.
Yes, so true. Yeah. So we had some really good times in Honduras. It was fun.
And it seems like, and not that this is what it's about, but they were so, one, they were incredibly gracious hosts
mm-hmm.
and seemed to be mm-hmm. very just grateful for you and Andrew.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even now, so her, one of her brothers is about to graduate from high school, and sometimes you can kind of choose people to sponsor you when you graduate. Those people are typically there in person, but he was sending us a message telling us that he was going to be thinking about us as his, you know,
wow.
sponsors, when he graduates. And so, yeah, that graciousness has continued, and, just feel really connected and feel like in a lot of ways, what wasn't adoption of one child turned into, you know, almost like becoming family with a whole family.
Yeah.
And I mean, we really do feel a part of their family, and they have told us that too. So I think it's just a picture of the gospel, right? Like, we were just hearing today someone talk about how we're all part of the same family. I think it was Dominic.
Gillard.
Yeah. He was talking about how we need to see other people's children as our children. And, and really, you can't do that when you look at children as possessions, and you can't do that when you see parents only for their faults. And, part of the gospel shows us that we're all part of God's family, and it feels neat to actually experience that in a new way.
The other thing I was thinking was, like, I know you and I know Andrew, and I know that you're very sensitive to advocating, not turning into exploiting, and that it was very important to you that Lupe wanted this story to be told. And hers and Julia's together, and that she was very, very much wanting you to write this book and tell this story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really huge honor, right, to carry someone else's story and to share it, and to just feel trusted with it, because it is such a heavy story. And I'm not sure I always do that right or well, and I'm not sure I always will, but knowing that she, you know, her desire is for this to help other people who are in her situation. And so the hope is that it can get into the hands of those who are in that situation, have to make that difficult decision. And maybe be able to make a more informed decision about what they're going to do.
Yeah. And so that's something that I wanted to ask about, because the book is like an intersection of so many things, of immigration and also, you know, kind of our country's involvement in other countries.
Yeah.
And then also the foster care and adopt system as well. It's the intersection of all of those things. And so I wonder just what you want other people to know about all that, and what you like, what you want other people's responses to be.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing that I want other people to know or to gain out of the book is, you know, we talk a lot about othering others a lot, you know, like that's a typical conversation that I feel like I'm having with other Christians, is it's easy for us to other other people. But I guess my hope is that in any of these systems, when somebody reads this book, that they can really start to ask themselves, who am I othering? Because, you know, in immigration, it's easy to other people who haven't come across the legal way, quote unquote, or are undocumented living in this country, or even commit a crime while being undocumented. It's easy to, and by other I mean demean the humanity of them and mar the image of God that is in them by how we talk about them or by how we assume that they should receive a certain punishment. And in foster care, I mean, really, like it really irks me when people demean or mar the image of God in biological parents who have their children in foster care. I think that, you know, I think it's on us. Like it shows our own hypocrisy when we do that kind of stuff, especially when it's coming from Christians. It shows our own hypocrisy that it's easy for me to say this child holds the image of God. It's a lot harder for me to say the mother of this child holds the image of God just as much as the child does. And I guess I just hope that people will see the humanity behind the issues that are just, it's easy to just talk about this stuff and not actually see human beings as human beings in the process.
You give a long list of resources, of books and other kinds of resources that people can look into at the end of the book. So I think that's really helpful too.
Yeah, good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Well, Gina, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me. I love your podcast. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, stop it.
It's the only podcast I have a t-shirt of, just saying.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.